You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Yes, it is. All right. Hey,
good,
Alan.
Good afternoon, Lillian.
We are speaking first on Stephen Hawking, the late Stephen Hawking, who passed away at 76 last week.
He did indeed, and it was sort of immediately after the show last week, I guess. Got back and found that this was all over the news. Yeah, so very sad. So I guess, you know, we can just talk a little bit about him and what he did and stuff like that.
Definitely.
So as you said, he was 76, born in 1942. He did all the sort of quote-unquote normal things that academics tend to do. So he went through Oxford. He did his undergraduate at Oxford. And he just apparently scraped through with a first at Oxford.
A university.
Yes, indeed. Yes, he just scraped through. And apparently what he had to do was to have an oral exam because he was sort of on the cusp between a first and a second. And so they asked him, or they kind of didn't like him because they thought he was a bit of a smart ass and stuff like that. And so they said, well...
They thought he was a smart ass.
Yeah.
Like in a bit of a sarcastic way.
Yeah. He certainly had a sense of humour, by all accounts anyway. But when he got asked that question, they said, you know, what... what are you going to do? And he said, well, if you give me a first, I'll go to Cambridge, and if you give me a second, I'll stay at Oxford. And so they gave him a first.
Really?
Apparently, so the story goes. Yes, yeah.
So it was a bit of a fuck you, I'm off.
Yeah, kind of, yeah. Yeah, I don't think he enjoyed his time there. And then he went to Cambridge, and he started his PhD, and he really wanted to work with this guy by the name of Fred Hoyle, who was sort of big in physics in those days, who was going on about the Big Bang and stuff like that. But he wasn't able to work with him, which is probably a blessing in disguise. And so he started working out with another guy who was a cosmologist. And sort of a year or two into his PhD, he got diagnosed with motor neurone disease, as everybody knows. And so he was given 2 years to live at that stage.
What?
And he thought, you know, what's the point in keeping on going studying a PhD? I probably won't live to see it. But he did, and he kept going, and he got a fantastic PhD out of that. And then after that, he stayed on as a researcher at Cambridge for a while. Then he went to Caltech, which is the California Institute of Technology, which is the place to be in the USA. And he was there for a few years, and then he eventually returned sort of mid-70s to Cambridge to a full-time position, where he was the Lucasian Professor of Maths.
Whoa.
And he was the 17th Lucasian Professor of Maths. The second Lucasian Professor of Maths was one Isaac Newton.
Whoa.
Yeah. So they don't give those out, you know, to any old people.
Where does the name come from, can I ask?
I have no idea. Okay. I really should have looked that up. Probably somebody by the name of Lucas, I guess.
Okay.
Who was probably the first Lucasian Professor of Maths, I would guess anyway. But so it was about 300 years between him and Newton, obviously.
Right.
And... so, what did he do, I guess?
At this point, was he, in terms of his disease, was that deteriorating? Or?
Yes, it was, yeah. And apparently the most difficult thing for him to do was to speak, by all accounts. He really sort of lost the power of speech quite early, and it was very, very difficult to understand. But it wasn't until apparently about 1985 where he had a collapse or something in Switzerland, and they had to do an emergency tracheotomy. And he lost his voice as a result of that tracheotomy. And so that's where he ended up getting that terrible-sounding digital voice synthesizer that we all know him from, with the grating American accent. And despite all the sort of improvements in technology and everything, he just stuck with that for his whole life because I guess he figured that was his voice
now,
at the time.
Yeah.
And everybody knew, you know, what his voice was. So why is he so well-known? Well, obviously, the disease had a lot to do with that because, you know, there's a hell of a lot of physicists out there who've achieved just as much, if not more, than him, and nobody knows their names. So, the fact
that's
that
that's interesting that you say that. Because everybody does know
true.
Stephen
Hawking.
I have no sort of knowledge, actually, of what, really, the sort of stuff that he studied or the stuff that he does.
Exactly, yes. Yep.
But we know that he was this incredible...
Yes,
person.
Yes, yep. No, and you know, an undoubtedly incredible intellect whose body sadly, you know, failed him in an early age of life. And so, you know, this enormous intellect trapped in a useless body, unfortunately. And, you know, life must have been very, very tough for him. But by all accounts, he was, you know, fairly upbeat about things. I guess if you're told you've got 2 years to live and you live for another 50-odd, then, you know, even though it's probably not the best way of life, but, you know, it was he was extremely lucky to live as long as he did, I guess. Mm. So I guess, too,
that's them for them to decide whether if they, you know, in terms of the quality of life, mm-hmm. that's up to him.
Absolutely, yes. Yep, mm. No, I totally agree with that, yeah. So the work that he was really famous for was very early on in his career, as is the case with a lot of academics. If they're going to be sort of world beaters, they do their best work sort of straight out of their PhD, just after their postdoc, whatever. And he was made a fellow of the Royal Society at the age of 32, which is just ridiculous. You know, people work their lives to become fellows of the Royal Society. It's the highest sort of academic honour you can get in Britain. And to get it at age 32 is just crazy. So they obviously recognised that he was, you know, a very, very special talent, even at that very, very early age. And his work, as I said, that he was famous for was work on black holes. So
I did know that, actually.
There we go. So, yeah, yep. And he really made his name on that. And really sort of the geometry of black holes, the fact that they have to be spherical, this thing called the event horizon, where nothing can get out of the black hole. So that's sort of the surface of the black hole, as it were. And he, in collaboration with a guy by the name of Roger Penrose, who was a mathematician, did a lot of work on really sort of the mathematics and the thermodynamics and the quantum mechanics of black holes, and kind of made them a little bit more sort of understandable to the layperson, I guess. And some of the work that he did was following on, in fact, from a little-known New Zealand scientist who should be better known by the name of Roy Kerr. He was a mathematician. And he sort of solved all the equations for black holes and stuff before Hawking started his work. So hopefully he sort of gets a little bit of a mention in all of Hawking's obituaries, because, you know, he's a fine scientist. He's still alive. He was he did his PhD down at Canterbury, and I think he was a staff member there. But, you know, really remarkable stuff. So basically I think the reason that Hawking is so well known is because he wrote a book called A Brief History of Time, and that sold 25 million copies all around the world. And it's probably a book that's more purchased than read, maybe. I think there's probably a lot of copies sitting on bookshelves around the world that haven't been opened.
Right.
Maybe.
Why do you say that?
Oh, well, it's, you know, it's tough stuff.
Yeah,
you
right, know, okay.
Conceptually, it's very, very difficult stuff to get your head around.
People buying it because it's Stephen Hawking's book.
And they
then possibly not.
Might read the first few pages and think, oh. But, you know, that's what science needs, is more publicists and people who are going to write for the general public and be able to put things in words that everybody can understand, because science is, you know, very, very important to humanity.
It's funny you say that. I think from memory, I was at school at Auckland Girls Grammar, and we had a visit from his daughter.
Oh, wow.
Who came and spoke, because she wrote a book, but it was a fiction book about space.
Okay, yes. And
they may have the details incorrect, but obviously her science in that book would have been informed by quite...
By a good mind, yes.
Accurate information. So, you know, something, I mean, that's quite something, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, no, that's very cool. Yeah. Obviously, when he got invited to speak at conferences and stuff like that, he had to have a whole entourage of sort of people looking after him and everything. So it was horribly expensive to get to anywhere. And he had to fly by private jet because, you know, they couldn't get him on a normal plane and stuff like that. And all of the venues had to be wheelchair friendly, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, it was quite a mission, I guess, to get him to appear at places. And it was difficult for him. But, you know, he was working up until the day he died, sort of, you know, a couple of weeks before he submitted his final paper and everything. So he was still working. And he is probably the only person to both have appeared on The Simpsons and done lyrics on two Pink Floyd songs.
Very good reference there. That's quite the achievement, though.
Yeah, I reckon.
To appear on Simpsons, I think, too, and Pink Floyd.
Yes, yeah. No, when you're on The Simpsons, you've made it, you know.
Yeah.
So. But so now that he's gone, who's going to take his place? And the obvious one is probably Brian Cox. No?
Sorry.
Right, there we go.
Oh, wait. Okay, James has heard of him. Who is this person?
I have no idea. I've just heard the name.
Okay.
So he's a publiciser of physics as well, and his big claim to fame was that he was in a band called D-Ream, who had a hit, Things Can Only Get Better, sort of late in the 80s, and then he decided that the music industry wasn't for him, and he became a professor of physics.
Oh, okay.
So that's
a
nice little career path, that one. Yeah. He's very listenable too. He can put things in sort of nice, easy language. So
yeah. Important there.
So R.I.P. Stephen Hawking.
There you go. That is quite a nice little quoted all though. Thank you, Alan. All right. Well, we'll move on and talk about platypus milk.
Indeed.
What about this? Milk.
It's funny what catches your eye when you're sort of scanning the online newspapers and stuff like that. And this one just, you know, platypus milk could help cure disease and stuff like that. So obviously I had to read that. And
tell us more.
So there's some researchers in Australia, funnily enough, who've been studying platypus milk. And they found about sort of 7 or 8 years ago that it had really, really good antibacterial properties. It wouldn't touch all the good bacteria in your gut, but all of these nasty bacteria, it would, act as a really good antibacterial agent.
That's amazing.
And so what they've done now is they've traced that antibacterial activity to a protein that's found in the milk. And even more interesting, the protein has got a weird fold. Okay, proteins.
Yeah, what? How is it folded?
Okay, precisely, exactly. Right, so proteins are big, 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 big long molecules. Okay, they're just a big, like, you know, piece of string, basically. And when they're in our bods and our cells and all that sort of stuff, then they fold up in absolutely particular ways. And there's only two ways, really, that they fold. They fold into a thing called an alpha helix or a beta sheet. Okay, and those
James is nodding. Okay, we know.
So that's good. So that's really the only two ways that proteins are known to fold. But now they found this protein in platypus milk that's got this totally unprecedented method of folding, and so they're figuring maybe the antibacterial activity is linked to that, and so maybe if they can replicate that in perhaps other molecules, other protein molecules that they could make, then they might also exhibit these really good potent antibacterial properties, and they might maybe sort of be a replacement for antibiotics or something like that. Okay, so this is all pie in the sky stuff at the moment,
and also they'd have to like farm or harvest platypus.
Well, not necessarily. Well, platypus milk. Okay, then so the platypus is a protected species over in Oz, so they can't sort of touch them or anything like that. So, but you know, they can obviously get the milk and stuff.
How?
Well, in captivity. Well, apparently, okay, so here's something I didn't know. So you do know that platypuses?
Yes,
I don't. What do we call them?
I don't know. Yeah. English is my second language, so.
platypuses, let's say. So they don't have teats. And so somehow when they're feeding the young, they actually express their milk onto their tummies, and then the little ones lick it up, apparently.
Wow.
Now, because they don't have teats, that's not a sterile delivery system. Okay?
Because it goes onto there.
Because it's onto there. So that's why people think that maybe, possibly, they've got this antibacterial thing in them to sort of keep all the nasty bacteria away while they're doing this. Okay? So that's a theory. It seems reasonable to me.
Yeah.
So. But so, antibiotic a replacement for antibiotics through platypus milk, possibly. Who knows? But it's really nice. I mean, the really nice bit in this is the whole new folding of the protein, and that's a big, big, big discovery. And there's over 100,000 proteins that have been structurally characterized. We know how they fold, and this is the first one of those 100,000 that's got this particular fold in it. So that's quite big news.
Yeah.
So, yeah, if you're a biologist or... Yeah.
Right. Still not sold on the just going and taking the milk from...
Well, you know, all in the name of science.
Okay. Okay. All right, and our last story, this is not really science, but there is an advertising campaign from the University of Sydney to unlearn.
Yes,
that's the concept.
I encourage you all to visit the University of Sydney website. Now, the University of Sydney is ranked, I'm pretty sure, number one university in Australia. It's either that or the University of Melbourne, but they're certainly those are the top two. Very, very good universities, both in the top 50 in the world. And so the University of Sydney has seen it necessary to put out a new advertising slogan. And this slogan is Unlearn. And if I may, I'm going to read you what it says on their website.
Absolutely.
Okay, they start off by saying, learning is easy. Okay, now, you know, that's just not a very nice thing to say to start off with. Learning is easy, unlearning not so much. It takes bravery to be an unlearner, to be uncomfortable, unpopular, even unliked, to question the established and challenge the accepted, to unlearn truth. How the hell do you do that? Unlearn medicine, unlearn love. While learners become experts on the world, unlearners see it for what it could be. Imagine what would be possible if we all learn to unlearn. We've reimagined the way we teach so our students can reimagine the world.
Okay.
Okay, you said you were going to play devil's advocate.
Well, I'll let you go first.
No, where you go.
Because what is your issue with this?
What more is there to say?
I mean, are you worried that, people are going to dismiss truth?
Yeah, well, how do you unlearn truth?
But, okay, so this is where I know, but if you're coming from a discipline of science, right, where truth is truth, right, you test something to the point where you cannot...
Here we go. This is going to be an art science debate. Yeah, isn't it? Here we go. I can see this coming.
You cannot dispute the matter. School dear science, we'll do arts. Very good point. But you brought the topic into science.
Okay, here we go.
So when you look at in an arts discipline, you look at things that are constructed, right? And they are social constructs. So when something is considered the truth,
yes,
it can be disputed.
But is there any such thing as the truth then in that case? Is it
there
the
you
truth?
Go.
If it can be disputed, is it truth?
Okay, that's a point, right?
Yep.
This is
yep.
what I'm saying, that if mm-hmm. they are coming from the lens of looking at the world as this one type of norm or common sense mm-hmm. way yeah. of being,
yes. yep.
that is something that we should unlearn, right?
Okay, so, okay, right, this all comes out of, I think, anyway, so 2 points. So first, the fact that universities have to advertise, what a waste of bloody money for starters.
Okay.
It really is, true. And number two, this whole thing where we have it drummed into us that we have to teach critical thinking.
Yes.
Okay, critical thinking. Oh, it's also important, critical thinking. Critical thinking doesn't mean to question absolutely everything and say that it's bullshit. You know, and I think that's the lesson that the students get a lot of the time. I think, you know, critical thinking, oh, you know, you've got to question everything. No, you don't question the truth, you know. You might question maybe how we arrive at the truth. And I always tell my students to, you know, I stand up here at the front of the class and I tell you all of these things and you should be saying, well, how?
How does he know that's true?
How do you know that, you know? And, but unlearn. I mean, what a ridiculous slogan for a university, you know. I'm certain that this will be absolutely pilloried and they'll get rid of it in a month or
two. Do you
think
so?
I think so because they're going to be a bloody laughing.
But see, this is how, like, if you're coming to this, right, so for example, this is obviously my knowledge base and this is what I know, being raised in Te Ao Māori, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at something, so in that sense, my knowledge is learning that it's not good to sit on a table or it's... truth to that, right?
Yes,
and
yes.
in another way of looking at it, it's not true that it's bad to sit on a table.
Yep.
So in unlearning the fact that there are different world views, unlearning the fact that there is only one worldview and relearning that there are other ways of seeing things.
What's wrong with just learning those
without having to unlearn?
The worst thing of all, the word unlearn is in the Cambridge Dictionary, for God's sake.
Ugh. Oh. Ugh. Okay, so your issue is simply with the fact that people are advocating to unlearn as opposed to learning more.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I can probably agree with you on that. I'm absolutely gobsmacked, honestly. I think it's appalling. And indeed, the fact that universities have to advertise at all, I think, is just appalling. That we're trying to attract students, you know, because we're all funded on the number of bums on seats, et cetera, et cetera. It shouldn't be like that. You should go to a university because they give you a decent damn education, you know.
And there is a thirst for knowledge, a thirst for learning.
Amen, yes. Yeah. And it's not necessarily just a meal ticket to a job and all that. But,
yeah.
I mean, that you know, the boat's gone, the bus has left the station or whatever, you know, bloody phrases.
Well, we're moving into the neoliberal critiques of the academia, you know,
wow,
or critiquing neoliberalism anyway.
Indeed, you know, yes, indeed. Critical thinking. Even,
that's right.
If you would.
Critical thinking. Well, very good. I think you're questioning what they're putting out there, so being very critical. Anyway, thank you, Alan.
My pleasure.
For
always,
coming on the show today.
Always fun.
We'll see you next week.
Okay, see ya.
That was Dear Science. That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.